Happy New Year and welcome to the Rob Aguilar Show on Radio Free Brooklyn. We have a great show lined up for you today. Joining us, we have Ryan Leone. He is a former drug addict, a former drug dealer, and he did some time in the state penitentiary. And he's going to talk to us about his experience on how he got involved with all these crazy things. He also has a book out and it's available at Amazon. It's called Wasted Talent. So definitely stick around for that. It's a very interesting conversation. But before we get started, I'd like to remind you to please support our sponsors. We have Roan Jewelry. You can find them over at roanjewelry.com. That's roanjewelry.com. They have great gifts, so you make sure you check them out. When you support them, you help support this show. Also, if you'd like to get in touch with me, if you have suggestions, comments, or ideas for topics that you'd like for us to cover, shoot me an email. You can find me over at robaguilarshow@gmail.com. That's A-G-U-I-L-A-R. And if you want to co-host, shoot me an email. We can definitely make that happen. And I love to hear from you. We have a great show lined up. Stick around. You do not want to be left out.
From A1 Studios in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, New York, this is the Rob Aguilar Show.
Ryan, welcome. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Rob.
So, Ryan, you have a very interesting story, and I want to dig in and have you tell us about this interesting journey you've been on. You were a heroin addict?
Yeah, for 10 years.
How did you get introduced to heroin?
I started doing heroin in high school. First, it was cocaine, and I had a pretty serious cocaine dependency when I was 16. I was doing about 3 grams a day. So even at that age, I was spending about $100, and I had to sell it to support my habit. And eventually, heroin got introduced to me. At first, it was just smoking it. And it wasn't like it was a popular thing to do in my hometown, I mean, for high school students. But I was very much involved in the drug culture. And one thing led to another. I was introduced to heroin just by friends who were my age. And I started smoking it. And it definitely got its claws sunk into me right from the get-go. I mean, from the first couple times that I tried it, I started doing it every day. And I actually went to my first detox for heroin when I was 17. I got out. I got into a writing internship program in Boston. And I moved out there, and people were partying a little bit harder on the East Coast than what I was used to. Intravenous drug use was certainly at play. And I got introduced to the needle out there. And from that point forward, it was just a complete, you know, downhill struggle, just really trying to survive for 10 years. And, you know, I went to prison within that 10 years and got really ugly.
Was cocaine the first drug you've ever tried, or did you ever try like pot and stuff like that? Or did you just go straight into cocaine?
No, I mean, the first drugs that I really started trying was over-the-counter drugs like Coricidin and Marazine and stuff that we could steal from, you know, the drugstore. And after that, that was my first real experimentation into drugs. You know, marijuana came into play. I started smoking that every day. I started drinking every day in high school. So it was clear that I was an addict from the beginning. I got into a lot of the hallucinogens, a lot of LSD, a lot of mushrooms, mescaline, etc.
So you were into the whole psychedelic thing as well? Was that part of...
Oh, yeah. I was definitely involved in the psychedelic culture. I just, you know, I went to rave parties and... Yeah, I used to love tripping.
What is the difference between the highs? Let's say, for example, being on cocaine versus being on heroin. It's got to be different feelings, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess how you differentiate between the two is the way that I like to describe heroin is it's like when you wake up in the morning and your alarm clock goes off and you press snooze and you sleep in for an extra 5 or 10 minutes. And you're kind of in that limbo between sleep and being awake, and your body just feels in total bliss. That's what heroin always felt like for me, which is different than cocaine, which gave me a really strong sense of confidence, made me very talkative, and you know, the high lasts a lot less.
You said you were supporting your habit by dealing. What is it like to be in that world of dealing drugs? Is it glamorous like we see in the movies, or is it completely different than that?
I'd say that it's similar to what you see in film and what's portrayed in popular culture, in the sense that there's a lot of money to be made. I was making $10,000 a week in my peak, but I'd say it wasn't as dangerous and there wasn't an imminent threat like you see in a lot of films. I never had guns drawn on me as a result of selling drugs, even though I was selling pounds of heroin. And what ended up happening with me is I caught a federal case, and they said that I was part of a cartel with 109 other people, which was based out of Mexico. And I only knew one person. The federal government totally blew it out of proportion. I wasn't involved in any cartel. So it's not what you would think when you think of a cartel in the traditional sense of guys wearing bandanas out in the jungle with AK-47s. So it wasn't like that at all. I knew one lady, a fat lady in East Los Angeles, and I would buy a pound or two from her a week. And like I said, I would make about 10 grand a week breaking that pound down into ounces.
10 grand a week. So what does a pound cost?
The pounds that I was getting were going for $8,000. I made $10,000 profit. So at the end of the week, I'd see about $18,000, and then I'd put another $8,000 in to get another one. So I'd always profit $10,000.
How old were you when you were doing this?
That was going on when I was 21 to 23. So I was at the peak of selling drugs at those ages.
What are you doing with all that cash? That's a ton of money for a 21, 22-year-old to just have laying around in the house.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got an attorney. I put him on retainer, and I had him advise me. I said, you know, I have $200,000-$300,000 cash in my safe at once, and I want there to be some longevity in what I'm doing. What should I do with the money? And he said, well, you have to launder it. Well, I didn't know anything about laundering, so I Googled it. And I started researching how other drug dealers launder money. And, you know, I found that there's an easy way to launder money in the speculative market. So what I did is I started buying high-end art. I started buying lithographs by very famous and prolific artists like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Pablo Picasso. And what a lithograph is, it's a limited edition press. So it's like a silkscreen process that the artist does and numbers it in an edition. So there might be an edition of 100, 250. And I was buying these things for, you know, 15, 30, 50,000 a piece, hanging them up in my place. And I was also selling them. And by selling them, becoming an art broker, in turn, I was laundering the money and making it clean, because there's really no way to trace art. You could say that it was grandfathered down to you by a relative, you know?
Earlier, you said that you were in Boston on a writing scholarship. You sound like what would be a very intelligent, very intellectual kind of guy. One wouldn't think that someone as intelligent and as smart, with maybe potential to go into other things in life, that you chose a path of dealing drugs. You don't sound like what we would think is the stereotypical drug dealer. It's interesting how that worked out in your life.
Well, you know, I think for me, I just had a gargantuan habit. I mean, like I said before, I was sniffing 3 grams of coke a day back in high school. And I think that was a very telling sign of what was to come. When I was doing heroin, I was also smoking crack every day. I mean, sometimes I would smoke $600 worth of crack a day. And, you know, selling drugs was just a symptom of my addiction. It seemed like the more passive approach to being able to enable my habit, because I had a lot of friends that were doing very malicious and malevolent things like armed robberies, or, you know, these huge theft scams and all these schemes. And I thought, in thinking about it now in retrospect, that what I was doing was a more passive and more benign approach.
So kind of like nobody gets hurt kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I thought. I mean, that's a complete fallacy, and that's not the case. I'm sure that there's people that died because I was supplying so much heroin. I mean, people die from it. It's a very destructive chemical.
Did any guilt come afterwards because of that?
Yeah. I think that I contributed to perpetuating an epidemic in my town. And I, you know, I'm from Santa Barbara, California, which is a small beach town on the coast. And I was, you know, you start bringing a pound, 2 pounds of heroin in there a week, a lot of people are doing it, and a lot of people are doing it for the first time. So I definitely felt guilt when I got sober, and, you know, when I had some more clarity and got to think about the things that I had done. Yeah, it's a bad thing. Selling heroin's an ugly thing.
There's medical research out there that says that these addictions, or people that are addicted, can be traced to genetic traits. Do you find that that's accurate in your situation, or what drove you to the drugs? Was it maybe something not right at home, or was it just this pull that could be maybe genetic?
I mean, if you look at my immediate family, my mom and dad, very loving parents, have been married for over 35 years now, upper middle class, always provided me with all the opportunities I could ever want. But my mom's bipolar, and I think that I inherited that from her. Maybe not the addiction gene, but I definitely got some psychological deficits from her. I have ADD and I have bipolar disorder. And when you're 13, 14, 15 years old, you become very susceptible to drugs because you have a very low self-esteem. So it all comes down to confidence. I don't think I had confidence when I was that age, and drugs offered a very accessible way for me to escape and to feel more confident about myself. I mean, I think that's why I was drawn to cocaine so much.
You get arrested, and what was going through your mind? Did you ever think that you were going to get caught?
I knew I was going to get caught. Yeah. I was growing marijuana. I had two different houses that I was growing it at, you know, 200 plants for a 60-day cycle. I was selling kilos of MDMA. I was selling pounds of heroin. Like, I was selling a lot of drugs, and I was putting myself out there a lot. I knew that it was inevitable that I was going to get caught. So when those cuffs got put on me and I got arrested by the DEA, it was almost like I was washed over with relief. I was just so happy that it was finally over, because it's very nerve-wracking to go to sleep every night thinking that it could be your last night and that they're going to get you in the morning.
So then you go to trial and you're sentenced. How long did they sentence you for?
They sentenced me to 5 years. And the thing about the federal system is really messed up. They have mandatory minimum sentencing, which was enacted during the Reagan administration. And that means for what I got caught with, the minimum that I could do was 5. I had to do 5 years, and the maximum I could do was 40. I was very fortunate that my family paid for a good defense attorney, and I was able to get the low end of that bracket. But I've seen people get, for similar crimes that I committed, you know, 10, 20 years, multiple decades. It's just totally illogical.
So do you think that this whole war on drugs thing that we keep hearing about, is that just one big crock of bullshit, or is it real war on drugs that the government is wagering?
I think it's a bunch of bullshit. I mean, I didn't really have an intimate understanding of what the war on drugs really meant until I was imprisoned in our prison systems and started seeing people that were doing 20 years for marijuana. That one of the big injustices that's going on in the federal system and with the war on drugs that I think a lot of people don't know about is a phenomenon called ghost dope. And what ghost dope means is that they didn't even find physical evidence on you. There was no tangible drugs recovered. You're going to prison based on the testimony of snitches that had an incentive to testify in the first place. So there's a lot of people right now doing 30 years in prison just based off what someone else said about them. They didn't even get caught with the drugs themselves. And I think if more people knew about that, it probably wouldn't be occurring, because that's just, I mean, that's incredible. 30 years for, you know, that's less time, or that's more time than a lot of people get for murder in the state system.
Somebody can basically help the police or a DA or anyone like that frame someone and say, hey, I know this guy's dealing, and get a bunch of witnesses and not ever have any evidence, any physical evidence.
Absolutely. That. Absolutely. And it's terrifying. It's
fucking unbelievable.
It's fucked up. It's a bad thing. And I didn't know about this before. I mean, I used to be paranoid about talking on my cell phone when I was a drug dealer. And I mean, let me tell you, they really listened to your phone calls. There was a lot of people in prison that were in prison because of stuff they said over their phone.
There's actually evidence that everything that we do, phone calls, text messages, is a big thing. And all this is stored. And there's a giganormous database. I believe it's in, I want to say New Mexico or somewhere in that area, where the government built a facility where all this information is kept. And the system uses trigger words to set it off. Everything is recorded and saved. And there it is for the government to use and pull out whenever they need to look up something that Rob Aguilar said or Ryan Leone said. I think that's completely wrong and waste of taxpayer money.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's a complete waste of resources. And I mean, everything post 9/11, after the Patriot Act got enacted, and you know, after the radical politics of Bush, kind of trying to quell the post 9/11 hysteria, has really, really disrupted our sense of freedom in this country. And it's really gone downhill. And I didn't even think about stuff like that until I went to prison and saw just how unfair these people really can be to people. You know, you're talking about, there's guys doing 8 years in prison right now for getting caught with 5 boxes of Sudafed.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's really ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
So what was being in jail like? Do you remember that first night?
Well, the detention facility that I was at before I went to prison was very rough and very volatile. And I was almost relieved to get to prison, to get away from that group of people that were in the detention center. But prison ended up being just as rough as I would have expected it. And I think that first night when they lock the door and they still leave the hall lights on, so you're just kind of sitting in your bunk illuminated by the hall light, I think it really just hit me that, you know, this is the next 4 years of my life. Like, I really fucked up.
Were you ever scared?
I was at a high security prison for the first year that I was incarcerated, and I was scared every single day. Yeah.
Did you ever have to fight for your life?
I didn't have to fight for my life, but I got in about 3 fist fights. You know, it's everything in prison is measured by respect. And if somebody disrespects you, you have to fight. I mean, it's just so primitive in there. And, you know, yeah, I'm not a fighter, man. I don't have any violence in my past. I'm just not a violent guy. But yeah, I definitely had to engage in some violence while I was in there just to protect myself. And more importantly, to protect my name, because once your name gets, once people start saying that you're a punk or that you're weak-minded or that you are not a person that carries himself with respect, they start treating you accordingly, and it can just turn into a nightmare. So yeah, I had a fight, and I had a knife the whole time I was in prison that I had to keep kind of tied by my crotch. And that's not me. I'm not the kind of guy that walks around somewhere with a prison shank knowing that I actually might have to use it.
Originally, I guess when the whole concept of prisons was thought up, it was supposed to rehabilitate an individual. But based on what you're telling me, I can see why people, when they leave jail, are worse. Their minds are thinking differently. And it could be that they went in for something so stupid as having boxes of Sudafed in a bag, and maybe this person isn't a violent individual to begin with, but being that you have to kind of resort to that because it is a primitive environment, when you come out, it's almost like you were schooled on how to be a criminal. I don't see the rehabilitation portion of that, unless there's something there that we don't know about.
No, there's not. It exasperates an already shaky situation. Obviously, the majority of people that are incarcerated are drug addicts. That's a huge problem. So you're basically warehousing nonviolent drug offenders and you're radicalizing them. It makes you violent. I mean, I participated in more violence in prison than my entire life combined before that. And fortunately, I behaved myself and I was shipped to another prison in Wisconsin a year after I was in to take a drug program, which was a joke, by the way. I mean, I got expelled from it. So I did almost 3 years of my sentence at a pretty, pretty nonviolent place. It was as violent as your average keg party. I mean, there were fights, but there weren't stabbings. So it was a relief to get out of that combative situation that I was at the original prison, which was Victorville in California.
How do you get weapons inside a jail? You had a knife or a shank. Does it get smuggled in, or is this something that you make yourself with things that you have laying around?
No. All prisons have a work system. So you work in a warehouse during the day. I mean, if you choose to do that and you get paid, I think it's like, you know, $4 a day or something. It's something ridiculous like that.
Slave labor then.
Yeah,
on top of that,
there's
slave labor.
And, you know, it's the quintessential prison imagery of people manufacturing license plates on conveyor belts. It's shit like that, you know? And what happens is the majority of the shanks get made in these warehouses because that's where people have access to tools. So they have plexiglass knives, which is what I had because it could get through metal detectors. But then there's also knives that people make out of the prison bunk beds, out of the metal. And they use nail clippers to file down slivers of metal from the bunk. And then they wrap it in electrical tape at the handle. And it makes a very sharp and dangerous and scary knife.
So there's weapons in jail. That means that there must be drugs in jail also.
There's a lot of drugs in jail. I was definitely strung out the first couple years that I was in there. And it's a lot more expensive. Just to give you a point of reference, a gram of heroin in the free world, at least in California, is about $60. In prison, that same gram of heroin is $400. So it's very expensive to stay strung out in prison. And it's a miserable thing. You know, I used to have to call my parents and beg them to send $3,000 to so-and-so. And yeah, it was a really ugly situation.
How do they get the drugs in?
Well, in all prisons, they have contact visits. So what happens is people sort of recruit other people to come visit them and give them balloons full of heroin or crystal meth or marijuana. That's one way that it comes in. They're in visit and you're allowed to do two kisses. You're allowed to kiss your visitor in the beginning of visit and you're allowed to kiss your visitor at the end of visit. So they'll go in there and they'll already have balloons stuffed in their mouth. And when they go to do the first kiss, they'll just slide the balloons in with their tongue into the other person's mouth. The person swallows it, takes it back to his cell after the visit's over, swallows a little bit of shampoo to induce vomiting, and they vomit it out, and then they sell the balloons at a very inflated price. And, I mean, that's one way. Another way is the guards bring it in.
Oh, so the guards are in on it, huh?
The guards are really corrupt. I mean, it's usually pretty trashy people. And you got some slick-talking convict that goes up to them and kind of turns them out and says, look, you know, do you want to make $60,000 a year or do you want to make $150,000 a year? And it's usually a pretty good sales pitch for these people that come from low socioeconomical backgrounds, low education. They're usually willing to take the risk, and it only means a couple years in prison for them. So, I mean, it's not as bad as a lot of these guys that are doing 10, 20, 30 years, you know?
And that's if they get caught. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure many guys go years without getting caught.
Yeah, usually they don't. There's everything in prison. I mean, I did everything from LSD to crystal meth, you know? There's everything in there.
How do you get your hands on that kind of cash? Where do inmates get $400 to pay their dealer in jail?
Well, everything in prison is based off a stamp system. So you have what's called a book of stamps, and it's 20 mailing stamps like you use to mail a letter, and 20 stamps equals $5. So everyone pays in stamps. And how that money gets turned into street money is somebody will accumulate $5,000 worth of stamps, and they'll go up to another inmate and say, okay, I have $5,000 worth of stamps that I'll give you for $2,000 if you can have your family send my family $2,000. So that's how they wash the money and turn stamp money into regular money. And stamps can be used to buy anything. You can buy tobacco. You can get tattoo work done. You can buy pornography. You can buy burritos from people that make them. You can buy sodas from people that sell them. I mean, the whole economy in prison is based off stamps.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and you have to adapt to it when you go to prison. It's just, and then there's commissary too, and you can do things with commissary. And usually the way that works is you're allowed to spend, I think it's like $400 a month on commissary. And you go to a little store and, you know, you get your ramen noodles and you get your Snicker bars. And when you owe somebody money, you say, give me a list. And they give you a little grocery list and you go pick it up for them. And that's a fair exchange as well.
When you come out of prison, has the world changed in 4 years or is everything pretty much the same?
You know, one thing I really noticed was Facebook. You know, it's ubiquitous now. Everyone's on Facebook. And when I went into prison, it was MySpace. And now MySpace is this totally like archaic ghost town. I mean, no one goes on that anymore. So it was interesting to see how Facebook really took a central role in the way things work as far as social media goes. And, you know, there were little technological advances like the iPhones have Siri now and they have Redbox at the grocery stores and Netflix really became a big power force as well. A lot of people are on dating sites. That wasn't big before I went to prison. Now everyone's on dating sites. There's been a proliferation in podcasts like the one we're on right now. I mean, this stuff wasn't going on as much before I went in.
How are you feeling emotionally when you get out?
To be honest with you, I really had a tough time getting out of prison. I didn't adjust well. I got out and I was absolutely psychotic. I think a lot of that can be attributed to my heavy cocaine use because I would have very intense paranoia. Like I'm engaged. And when my fiance and I started dating, I would just constantly think she was cheating on me. I'd check her phone, check her emails. Like, I just didn't trust her at all. And it was just this very intense paranoiac, I don't know. It was this really weird energy that I was having. And I think that all stems from 4 years of being confined mixed with, like I said, heavy cocaine use before that. And I got on antipsychotic medication and I totally leveled out. I'm not paranoid at all anymore. I totally trust my fiance 100%. And we have a really great relationship now, but it was a really tough adjustment when I came home and I was sober for the first time in 10 years. So it was almost like I hadn't been in the world for 14 years instead of 10.
Are you completely drug free now?
I'm off heroin. I don't smoke weed. I don't drink. I'm open to psychedelic drugs still. And I guess the way that I would say my recovery is I'd only take a substance that I think would enhance my life. And stuff like LSD, psilocybin has been pretty therapeutic for me in the past. And it's something I'd still be open to doing. Not advocating that for everyone, but for certain people, I think it really helps to get outside of your own perspective for 12 hours at a time and really, you know, internalize what everything means.
You're not the first person to say that about psychedelics. I hear a lot of people who suffer from anxiety or paranoia or psychosis or things like that. Things like ayahuasca, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I am.
At all. They say that when they first try ayahuasca, it is like almost an instant cure to depression, to anxiety, to all these different things that when they were on medication for that, and whenever they'd get off the medication, they'd be worse than when they first got on. And it was like this never-ending cycle. But the ayahuasca seemed to have set them free and doesn't seem to have any dangerous side effects like other types of drugs.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, I look at psychedelics as a means to make my life better. And I really take it from a mature standpoint. If I take LSD, I'm taking it because I'm looking for a sense of therapy. I'm looking to better connect with my fiance on a different level. And I know that that's probably an extreme view to a lot of people, but I don't know. I hold affection for those substances, and I don't see it being a detriment to my recovery. I still consider myself sober. you know, if I, even if I choose to do that kind of stuff once in a while. And when I say once in a while, I'm talking about once a year.
I have a lot of friends and acquaintances that have tried it that were to the point where they did not want to live anymore. They couldn't control these crazy feelings that they were having. And it also helped with, like, I want to say their creative juices. Now they're like the happiest people ever. And it's a complete, complete turnaround. And it's kind of shitty that a lot of these things are illegal when these things can actually help people.
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, I have said this before, but I remember specifically taking peyote when I was 17. And that's a heavy trip. You know, that's, you're talking about over 2 days of hallucinating and very, very reflective thoughts. And what I got from that experience was I started looking at my life and I started looking at how my actions were affecting my family. And it was the first time that I actually saw that from a different perspective. I got some objectivity. And I think objectivity is so important. And I don't think that you can get that through a lot of channels. I know meditation can get you there as well. And it's something that I'd be open to doing. But the point is I took something from a psychedelic trip and I applied it to my daily life. And it really made me start looking at my family different and being more grateful and, you know, just really exhibiting gratitude in times that I think that they needed to see it. I don't think that I would have felt that way if I hadn't had a profound experience like that. And ayahuasca, yeah, I've heard it's just completely cathartic, and it really allows people to face demons from their past. I know that's a big thing with ayahuasca. I'm totally for it.
Now, if you could go back in time, here you are today looking at Ryan back when he was 21. Could you offer any advice to Ryan back then?
Yeah, I could. I would definitely tell him that there's an easier way, you know, that you don't have to go to prison to get sober, because that's really what it came down to. Is I knew I had two options. I was either going to go to prison or die. And I had tried getting clean so many times. I'd gone to rehab after rehab after rehab and nothing was working. And I just couldn't get off the heroin and I couldn't stop doing the coke. And I thought back then very foolishly that if I did go to prison, that would be the intervention that I needed. And I would tell myself back then that it's definitely worth not giving up for, that I should have kept going to rehab, that I should have never given up, no matter what, that, you know, anything would have been better than prison.
Any other regrets?
My biggest regrets is, you know, just the way that I treated my loved ones, and including friends. I was just so selfish when I was an addict, and I didn't see it back then. And I really just regret how I used to be and that I was so self-centered. I mean, when you're sticking a needle in yourself, you're hurting every single person that's ever cared about you. People are literally watching you die in front of them, and it's a slow death. And it's a horrible thing. And I truly regret any pain that I afflicted on anybody that's ever cared about me, including myself.
Now, your book, Wasted Talent, is any of that based on what you've lived?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially a thinly autobiographical book. You know, I made the main character a musician. I'm not a musician, but it very much deals with the adventures that I had while destroying my life. And it's told very episodically. And yeah, I'm really proud of it. The book's done a lot better than I thought it was going to do. And I couldn't be more humbled by that.
Where can people find this great book?
It's on Amazon. It's on BarnesandNoble.com. You can get it at WastingTalent.com. And if you want to ask me any questions, I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is RyanLeone85.
The book is called Wasted Talent, Ryan Leone. Thank you so much for your time. I would invite you to buy this book. Check it out. It's available at Amazon.com, also available at Barnes & Noble's. And if you want to reach out and talk to Ryan, you can find him on Twitter. Ryan, give us that Twitter again.
It's RyanLeone85.
Ryan, thank you so much.
Rob, it was a pleasure talking to you, man.
Again, Ryan Leone, you make sure you give him a follow on Twitter and that you check out his book, Wasted Talent. So I'd like to tell you about an event that I'm going to be at on January 20th, taking place at the Mid-Manhattan Library. It's going to start around 6:30, and the Mid-Manhattan Library is located at 455 Fifth Avenue here in New York, New York. It's going to be a conversation with Yoan Grillo and Bernardo Reese. Bernardo Reese is a documentary filmmaker. Yoan Grillo is a good buddy of mine. He's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks, and he is a journalist, he's a writer, and he's a TV producer based in Mexico City. He's got a couple of really interesting books under his belt. He basically covers the drug cartels, and he's got some really interesting books about that culture and that whole scene. And this conversation taking place on the 20th is going to go into the history of drug trafficking and the incredible, shocking stories of these men at the heads of these cartels throughout Latin America. So it's definitely a very interesting event. If you're into crime and knowing about how that whole underworld works, I think you will find this conversation very interesting. Again, that's January 20th at the Mid-Manhattan Library, starting at 6:30 p.m., located at 455 Fifth Avenue here in New York, New York. Definitely stop by, say hello, shake some hands, we'll take some pictures, and we'll hang out and get to know each other. So I want to thank you for hanging out on this first episode of 2016. Stick around. Up next, we have Tripping Beats. I will see you all in the promised land.
I'm not afraid to die. irte. Es el momento de decir adiós. Recuerda que los que se quedan no lo pasarán mejor. Y te das cuenta que es más fácil esperar y alargar el camino que más tarde nos va a separar. Muchacho, vete ya a otro lugar. Cabeza alta y lágrimas, porque regresarás. Ya verás, aguanta el tiempo y anda. Despídete, pero no dejes de mirar atrás. Abrázame, tu calor me llene hasta que vuelvas. Y te das cuenta que es más fácil esperar y alargar el camino que más tarde nos va a separar. Muchacho, vete ya a otro lugar. Cabeza alta y lágrimas, que regresarás. Ya verás, aguanta el tiempo y anda.
Sonrisa la imagino sin miedo. Invadido por la ausencia, me devora la impaciencia. Me pregunto si algún día te veré. Ya sé todo de tu vida y sin embargo no conozco ni un detalle de ti. El teléfono es muy frío, tus llamadas son muy pocas. Yo sí quiero conocerte y tú no a mí. Por favor, dame una cita, vamos al parque, entra en mi vida sin anunciarte. Abre las puertas, cierra los ojos, vamos a vernos poquito a poco. Dame tus manos, siente las mías, como dos ciegos. Santa Lucía, a mí.
La primera vez pensé, se ha equivocado. La segunda vez no supe de qué decir. Las demás me dabas miedo, tanto loco que andas suelto. Y ahora sé que no podría vivir sin ti. Por favor, dame una cita, vamos al parque. Entra en mi vida sin anunciarte. Abre las puertas, cierra los ojos. Vamos a vernos poquito a poco. Dame tus manos, siempre las mías. Como dos ciegos, Santa Lucía, Santa Lucía. A menudo me recuerdas a mí.
Yeah.